Welcome to Trans Canada Stories. I'm Sin Sweeney, and I'm joined by the lovely co-host, Emma Stanley. And in Trans Canada Stories, we're all about going beyond binary and telling stories of trans people as people. Welcome to the show. Okay, welcome to Trans Canada Stories. We are joined in studio today with the fabulous Terry McDowell, who we first had on Haces podcast. It was in January of 2023, so a little over a year ago now. And Terry, if you'd like to introduce yourself, I'd love to just hear a little bit about what you've been up to since we last talked. I know that you're still with EY. I don't know if you've moved around in there, but you're probably wearing a new hat with a national nonprofit organization too that we'd love to hear about.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Sin, and good to see you again, Emma. Glad to be on. Some things have changed, much has stayed the same. I had the pleasure, as you said, to join you a little over a year ago on this podcast. And I am still at Ernst & Young, so EY is still home to me. Still serving as a tax partner there, kind of a senior advisory partner these days, so more a consultant within the practice to other partners in the practice. So that's exciting, a new venture yet again, which always keeps things fresh. But outside of EY, a couple of things have kind of been taking my time as well. I did join the board for the US LGBTQ Chamber of Commerce. We're based here out of Toronto, but we're a national chamber, so we have representation across the country. That's been a very exciting experience. I admit I'm still learning how to be a board member in that organization, all the constituencies that we serve, but it's a very important avenue for the queer community, queer entrepreneurs, queer business, but also corporates to be involved and be connected across the networks. So that's been exciting. And also serving on another board that's not nearly as exciting for this audience as that one, but I also sit on the Board of Governors for the Canadian Tax Foundation, where I chair the Finance Committee for that organization. So obviously near and dear to my professional career. We have about 13,000 members across the country, so it's a big constituency. Representation from government, academia, and then the professional service firms, as well as taxpayers at large. So between those two things and my 9-to-5 job, I'm finding ways to keep busy.
Well, and it's great that you could find some time to talk to us. I think people are either terrified or very excited to hear the word tax in the month of April. I don't know. It's great that we even managed to carve some time out for you to join us today.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, to say to the audience, we're not going to talk a lot of tax today, I don't think. So
no tax. No, we will not talk tax today. We are talking. We had a great chat. So I first met Terry for background at the, so when you say the 2S LGBTQI plus Chamber of Commerce, for listeners who don't know, it's formerly the CGLCC. And we met at the awards back in 2022, where you were, you took home the fabulous recognition of being the Business Leader of the Year. And then you came on and talked to us a little bit about that. And also we talked about inclusion in the workplace, because being a trans woman working in C-suite, having worked in various locations, you're in Toronto now, but you've been in New York and elsewhere, you've got a lot of really great experience and knowledge that you can share with listeners and helping them to think about elevating their careers if they're a part of the community, or how to be a better ally and more inclusive if they are not.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Sin. And I think that's largely the direction we're going to take today and talk about some of those things. But I've been, again, not to repeat what was on our last time together, but I have been very fortunate that I have had an opportunity to move around North America, always with the same company, and always kind of gave me a chance to progress, not just professionally, but also personally, and also in my own personal transition journey. It's given me lots of opportunities. So I think one of the things I really treasure of that experience, particularly as I'm getting later in my career and starting to look back at it, is I've had a nice mix of working in smaller centers as well as some of the largest centers. And so coming to appreciate not just differences, but more importantly, I think similarities of what that really represents and the differing communities that we encounter both professionally and personally as we go through our occupational and personal journeys in life kind of thing. And I really kind of like to emphasize the similarities. People are people wherever you end up, and it's all about finding network and trying to create those allyships across the aisles, if you will. So,
That's wonderful. First, working on the board of the on the tax board, do they have a strong inclusion commitment?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, because I've been in the profession for close to 40 years, and I've been a member of that organization for most of it. My own experience with the foundation, for what it's worth, has been very positive. I mean, I was invited to be on the board. I'm an open trans woman on Bay Street, all the rest of it. So that was never a factor. And not surprisingly, you know, if you go back to the late 80s, when I really joined that organization as a kind of newbie sitting in the back rows and listening, and then through the 90s, et cetera, I would have described it back then as an old boys club. It was, you know, it was the typical Bay Street button down black suit, blue suit, blue tie kind of crowd, and that dominated. You started to see the demographic in the profession and in that foundation start to shift, I would say in the 90s, late 90s, Emma, but the shift was not towards true inclusion. What we did see was a lot more women represented, and the population started to become a little more gender balanced. I hesitate to say we've achieved gender parity. We're pretty close in terms of when you look at absolute membership numbers, it becomes pretty close. So the organization has evolved a lot. I think in terms of queer representation and gender diverse representation, all of those types of things, we're catching up, is the way I would put it. We do have a DEI committee that's formed, and you know, that goes across racial demographics, gender demographics, and as well the queer community is represented. But you know, it is something that, as an organization, I would say it's been a little longer to take root in, but it's taking root because our constituent members have been paying attention for quite a period of time now. And so, of course, it comes from the membership. It comes from the grassroots. And I think that's really critical anytime we're talking about these inclusion mechanisms. So in terms of, is it something that's been at the forefront of thinking? Of course not. But that's not the purpose of the organization, of course, either. It's to be welcoming to all, but it's a professional community. And so I haven't encountered resistance. I haven't encountered discrimination, to use that word, et cetera. But I think the understanding around why it's important and how to achieve the greater good and the importance of inclusivity, I would say it's a work in process, but a positive work in process is the way I'd like to spin it.
So that leads me to maybe my real question. You're working on two boards right now. One is sort of explicitly queer friendly, and its entire mandate, you could argue, is inclusion, and another one that's kind of had to grow into it through policy changes. What are the differences in your experience between those two spaces? And is the one driven by more lived experience different than the one that's driven more by top-down policy?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot wrapped up in that, obviously, Emma, because they, and I'll try to dissect it and put it in perspective. I mean, they're very, very different organizations in terms of their raison d'etre, of course. And the easier one to speak to, of course, is the chamber. The chamber is there, and its primary reason for existence is to enhance and improve the experience of the queer community and the queer business community in particular. So that's why it's there. That's why it's needed. You know, there's a variety of initiatives that are core to its being. There's the Rainbow Registry for queer-friendly businesses that get in. There is the diverse supplier accreditation that goes, which, you know, requires a certain number of queer ownership percentage in a business to get that type of certification, et cetera. So that is its reason for being there, its constituency, its members, its entire policy is built around support for the queer community. You contrast that for a moment with the Tax Foundation, very different mandate. Our mandate is really around understanding tax policy. So I don't think you could get things too much further apart on the spectrum of reasons for organizations, which is why I like being part of both, to be honest.
Very much.
It gives me this incredibly diverse experience, but still, you know, part of the broader community, part of the broader society. So, you know, the tax community is really our mandate. And again, it's not about advocacy per se. It's about communication and education of where tax policy is. It's a very apolitical organization. Let me make that very clear. It's not it by definition and by guideline is not affiliated with any political party in any way. It's really about an educational forum for those of us who are crazy enough to be interested in what tax policy is all about. And it's been around for over 50 years. So it's longstanding. And you can probably tell as I start to ramble on, I really enjoy being part of it. I've been fortunate enough to find a career that really invigorates me, that just tells you how weird I am, because it happens to be tax. But yes, and then kind of to bring it full circle to your question, I never really thought about it, actually, Emma, other than one nurtures my professional soul and one nurtures my personal soul. And there's obviously a bit of a Venn diagram where you get a bit of both from the experience of being involved with those types of concentrically different organizations.
No, I love that. I find it very interesting. And yeah, how the two can kind of complement each other and feed your soul, like you say. I know when we talked a little bit about inclusion in the workplace when we were last talking, if you're in a situation where maybe you have a team member that is working with a client, or you're in client management and you're working with a client and you're feeling like maybe they're coming into the client relationship and you sense some tension, or that maybe there's some education needed there, or maybe there's just straight out language is harmful, transphobic. Let's dissect that a little bit of what are some opportunities on how somebody could address that if they're a third party working with a supplier, but they also have a team member, or if it's happening to them themselves, on, you know, what companies maybe have in place, or, you know, what kind of steps could be the way to work through that before you maybe have to make a decision on whether you're going to continue to work with that client or not, which is really challenging.
I'll share my thoughts, and to be clear, these are my thoughts, my experiences, et cetera. So I think it's going to vary across, what others have experienced and other organizations, et cetera. But I do think, and something that I referenced in our last chat that I think sets the tone across the top, is what I refer to as tone from the top. And so I'm quite proud of our organization. I think we've been out in the front foot of these types of initiatives, whether it's queer inclusion or racial diversity or just gender parity, those types of things. I think we were an early adopter in many ways and realized the need for this and the fact that it's just good business. But that's great lip service until it comes time to put these things in action. And so speaking in terms of institutional safeguards or policy, if you will, it really has to come from the C-suite. It has to come from the top. And there, you know, it's not dictatorial. It has to be lived and breathed by the presidential suite, the chairman, the executive committees, et cetera. And they have to be consistent in that messaging. They have to adopt, and they have to show that they have they have to show that they've got the backs of their constituencies. In a professional services firm like ours, your constituency is your people. It's your fellow partners, but also all of the staff that work with us. When you know, we have a broad footprint, and believe it or not, if you look globally to the size of our firm these days, we're almost 400,000 people around the globe. So, you know, we're huge. We're in 183 countries. You run into geographic differences as well as just sheer scale. You run into political differences, of course, and you run into legal differences in certain parts of the world, as we're painfully aware. So, but nonetheless, trying to get that consistency of tone from the top speaks to the internal part of what's there, and knowing that in my case, as a trans woman, I've got the support where it matters the most, and I'm going to get that support. That gives you that blanketed security, if you will, that sense of self, that ability to show up for your job every day unencumbered by inhibition of, you know, are people noticing how I'm dressed today? Are people noticing how I speak today, as opposed to my professional credentials that I'm bringing to the table, which is why I'm there to begin with? That all speaks to kind of inside the walls, if you will. I think that the more interesting dynamic is when you're in a professional services firm, such as I am, you are dealing with external clients all of the time. Mm-hmm. And those safeguards are not necessarily there all the time. So you know, you deal with a range of clients across a range of industry, across a range of cultural DNA in those organizations. And as advisors, as third-party contractors for those organizations, we can't dictate to them what those values can be. What we can do is bring our values to the table and continue to live our values, even in commercial relationships like that. Again, not to overblow it, not to just speak to one institution, but I was kind of given pretty good blanket assurances early in my career as my journey commenced that would never be an issue, that if we ran into that issue, we had coverage, we had air coverage to kind of go back and speak to the parties that be within our organization, but we would not sacrifice the welfare of our own people because of a client relationship. Fortunately, I can say I've never had to face that. Are there microaggressions that occur in client sites or to a lesser extent within your own building? Yeah, I mean, again, I'll repeat a phrase I've used before. It's not always rainbows and unicorns. You know that. And so you have to be prepared for that type of chatter. Those microaggressions do occur. But one of the things that I think is critically important, and this is where our allies show up for us, is having people defend you when you're not in the room. Kind of thing. So whether that's at a client site, which could occur, or whether that is just within your own four walls, it, again, tone from the top, that needs to be instilled that, you know, if you hear the talk, if you see the action, that type of thing, call it out and know that you've got the coverage. More difficult to do in a client commercial circumstance, and I fully appreciate the practicality of that. It doesn't make it any less important, Sin. I think you still have to live and be guided by those core principles. And, you know, would it ever come to a circumstance that you lose a client, lose a contract over it? I'm really fortunate to say that's never happened in my career. Has it impacted? Sometimes you just never know, right? Like it goes around you. And things of that nature, but it's not as big of a, I think we build it up in our own minds sometimes as being a much bigger consequence or implication, et cetera, than the experience necessarily transpires all the time. It does happen, and I'm not trying to pretend that, again, that everything's rainbows and unicorns, but I kind of like to focus on the positive and go, those are really outliers, and they're becoming more and more the outlier situation at this point in time. And I don't think that that's dependent on size of the counterparty, i.e. size, you know, sheer employee numbers, revenue numbers, et cetera. I think its cultural DNA has shifted over the last 20 years, and people are just a little more in tune with inclusivity and recognizing we're not all that different at the end of the day, and we're here to do a job, and you know, you try to connect those dots. I hope that it doesn't sound too glossy, because I don't want to I don't want to pretend that it never happens, because it certainly does. But it's, I do think in my own experience, I can say with credibility, it's an outlier if it happens. And, mm-hmm. and I've could only count maybe two or three mm-hmm. times where I felt were certain it was happening, as opposed to maybe two or three other times when is it happening? And I was never 100% certain. So it's, so I'll pause there. That's a stream of consciousness on a very interesting topic that deserves a lot of time to be delved into, to be honest. And I don't think there's ever going to be one right answer, and there's certainly never going to be one unique experience or one specific yeah. experience that speaks to all that's out there. So.
Time to take a break from this Trans Canada Stories for a TD Connected Communities moment.
Trans Canada Stories are your stories, and we're all about connecting communities right across Canada. We would love to hear from you. What topics would you like us to cover? Do you know someone who'd like to be a guest on the show? Follow the link in the show notes and share with us, how can we make Trans Canada Stories great for you?
That was a TD Connected Community moment, because community matters. I've asked this question of a couple of guests on the show, and it's one that I find pretty interesting. And it speaks to your experience where this sort of transphobia is getting to be more and more of an outlier experience. And we're very pleased with that. But as we move from a survival situation to maybe a more maintenance situation, as far as queer inclusion in, let's say, the safer spaces, in services in corporate, what strategies do you think might need to change from companies to support maintenance?
Let me address that in a broader context of kind of mm-hmm. what's going on across the Americas for certain, and definitely around the world. I think if you go broader, and then we can try to focus on the corporate sector. I think, you know, despite all the progress and despite the fact that I like to think we're past the survival stage for the queer community in general and the trans community in particular, and we're, you know, ideally creating environments for people not to survive, but to thrive. Emma, I think we're also seeing, particularly south of the border, but also here in Canada, we're seeing political backlash to that progress.
Mm-hmm. Worldwide, I would say, but yeah.
Yeah, very, very much against the trans community in particular. It's not limited to North America. We, of course, know what's going on in the UK and the politicization that's occurred with the recent CAS report, for example, and things of that nature. So it's very real right now. I do think it's driven. I know. I shouldn't say I think. I think the empirical evidence is there that that type of momentum, despite the groundswell and the damage it's doing right now, can be traced to a very discrete number of groups that are pushing this type of mm-hmm. legislation. I do not truly believe that it's indicative of the wider population or a wider backlash, if you will, against the progress that's been made. I think there's a number of factors have allowed a very vocal minority to get footholds and create some of the damage that we're seeing occur, particularly in state legislatures. But I know, Sin, a year ago, we talked a little bit about this, and it was Oklahoma at the time that was out in the front foot about this. And I feel a little prescient with my comment in that I said, you know, people say that's Oklahoma, it's a long ways from here, and it's not. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we're less than mm-hmm. a year and a half later, and we've seen it trickle north of the border. We've seen what's happened. Mm-hmm. In Saskatchewan, New Brunswick, Alberta more recently, that type of mm-hmm. thing.
And areas really, of Toronto or areas of Ontario
absolutely, yeah.
as well.
You look mm-hmm. at the school systems are right in the GTA mm-hmm. here, and those are, again, harmful examples that are there. So that rhetoric is out there. And again, mm-hmm. to repeat the phrase earlier, mm-hmm. it's not always rainbows and unicorns. That's the reality of the environment we're living in. So to get to your direct question, Emma, I always think of it in that context of it's those external forces that are going to put pressure on the corporate boardrooms and the corporate sector, et cetera. And when we go through periods like we're in right now, it's absolutely incumbent on the Bay Streets of the world to stand firm. You know, there's a reason that companies adopted DEI. There's a reason that they adopt inclusivity, and it's not out of the pure goodness of their hearts or the better search for mankind. I'd like to believe that was the reason, but we're capitalists at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Good business. It's good business. You know, you attract more talent in the door with mm-hmm. those policies. You get the best of the best in the door. You get more access to a broader spectrum of community and things of that nature. And I think those principles have proven themselves to such an empirical degree that, again, maybe I'm overly optimistic here, but I believe the corporate community, the business community, the broader community sees the value in that and will not allow these other undercurrents to really take hold and manifest themselves in damaging ways. So I think it's incumbent on the corporate sector to hold firm on the policies they've adopted and the progress that they've made on our behalf. So
I'd love to jump in there a little bit just to see how, so, you know, what I've seen and heard is with the groups being so strong with the messaging that they're sending, and it's really targeting that transphobic message to newcomers and people that have come from a culture where perhaps, you know, they're not as caught up with human rights as around gender identity. So one incident was with a school where parents weren't familiar with, you know, gender identity and trans inclusion. They've come from a country that is not inclusive, and they are, you know, potentially pushing back and really upset about schools talking about gender identity. These same people that are going to work in, you know, your workplace or another corporate or maybe a small business. And so what do you think, you know, how do we tackle that? Like, how do you, you know, how do you diffuse the strength of the message, the misinformation that's being sent specifically to those particular groups?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting dynamic, Sin. And, you know, obviously we see a lot of it in the GTA because we're such a culturally, racially diverse center, one of the most diverse in the world, not just in the Americas. And so we see a lot of culture clash, if you will. But I think there's a lot of dichotomy in that as well. I mean, the same things that you're talking about, it's a lot of people end up in a Toronto of the world or a city like Toronto of the world because they see the freedom from those past mm-hmm. experiences, et cetera. But at the same time, that cultural DNA does follow certain demographics mm-hmm. and it is there. So I think the broader comment that, again, personal dogma and all the rest of it in terms of what I think visibility matters. I think doing podcasts like this and getting the message out there in broader forums and what I'll call more mainstream forums too. So, you know, taking it out of just the queer channels and getting it into mainstream channels so that people start to see that we're just living, working, and doing our daily lives just like everyone else is. And we happen to be trans or bi or gay or lesbian, whatever kind of thing. I think people need to see that to embrace it. And it's a lot harder to discriminate against a person once you've met someone that comes from that community. And so visibility matters. So
I think with visibility too, and on to your point earlier in the conversation too, when you talked a lot about reflecting back on your own career and looking at the sameness and the differences, you know, the similarities and the differences in interchanges, exchanges that you've gone through. And I think you can, maybe that's the opportunity, is bringing, you know, these different cultures together. Perhaps they've come here because they've been persecuted where they were, or they have gone through something that's very similar but different, and finding that common ground can build that empathy for understanding.
Yeah, and I think the whole, you know, the whole immigrant situation is something that I can only speak to anecdotally, of course, because I don't have that lived experience. But, you know, the reality is I have to believe people who come from other cultures, other countries, they come with from what they know to the complete unknown. And this is sometimes just one anchor that they bring along with them in terms of what their lived experience, their lived knowledge, their lived culture has been up until this point in time. And so now they're in a, you know, brand new situation, brand new country, brand new culture. It takes time to win over hearts and minds and realize that the similarities are bigger than the cultural differences, if you will. So
it's true. The conversations are so important, you know, just having the conversations and building upon them.
Absolutely. And again, I think the broader the footprint we can get across all segments of society, I guess, is only going to enhance the ability to bring everybody to an equal footing. So,
do you worry about travel anymore, Terry? Like, I know you've worked and lived in different countries, and you had mentioned, though, that you're going to be doing some exciting traveling coming up. And do you feel apprehensive about that ever, or just pure excitement now? Or how do you lead into that?
So, yeah, there's again a lot of levels to talk about there. I love to travel. I've had a tremendous career that's allowed me to travel a lot. And even if it was work travel, I used to get very excited about it. I don't know if it's age or what it is these days, but the work travel has kind of lost its glamour these days. And it's not really related to the trance experience directly. It's more just, I like to travel for me these days, not so much for business. Where it does intersect, and I would say that this is a little more small P political for me, as opposed to even personal safety experience, et cetera. But there are jurisdictions, particularly states, that I will put my hand up and say, I'm not going there. If I'm asked to travel on business, I will say no. And this is why. I don't know that that's the right answer, to be honest, because the flip side is a lot of people don't have that ability to say no. And so do I set the wrong example by exerting influence and saying, no, I'm not going to go there. But that I choose to spend my dollars in other areas. And, you know, I think to the extent I can influence decisions about where we spend our corporate dollars, et cetera, I'm not averse to being vocal about that and saying, have you thought about? And I'm a little bit privileged because of position, experience, tenure, all the rest of it. I can put my hand in the air and say no, but I also want that to be an example for other people to say, I just don't feel safe going to, and I'll name them. I don't feel safe going to Florida these days. I don't feel safe going to Tennessee these days. I don't want to go to Missouri these days. I don't want to go to Oklahoma or Texas these days, because here's the laws that affect me when I'm there. And I think that's more than fair to our people. And I think we have the ability to make those statements kind of things. So, so long ways to answer your question. I still love to travel, Sin. I love to travel for personal enjoyment, et cetera. But I also appreciate there's politics in addition to personal safety wrapped up with those decisions greater than there ever have been in my past. So.
No, it's great. It's great because, yeah, it's like it's personal and corporate governance, good governance and looking out for the safety for yourself, but also corporates have a responsibility of not sending somebody into a danger zone. And if it's, that's the political, it might be safe for other people within the company, but if it's not for you, yeah, you know, then they shouldn't be sending you there.
I'll give a shout out to the NBA still. I mean, it's almost 10 years ago when the first bathroom bill really came up in North Carolina at the time. And we have bathroom bills back, of course, at this point in time, but that was 2015, 2016. And the NBA All-Star game was supposed to be in Charlotte that year. And they said, no, we're pulling it. And that was estimated to cost the local economy close to $1 billion. And it shut that bill down. So that is the power of economic statement, if you will. And so I still go to that. That's such a powerful example in my mind. So
I know we're almost out of time. Can I just ask one other quick question, if you have a second? I know when we talked this time last year, I was eking up towards and had passed, I think, was 540 plus anti-trans bills that had, you know, had been proposed in the states. Seems like a lot of them are falling and not going through now. And do you think that was the overall strategy, that it was always known that they wouldn't go through, but it was just meant to be that disruptor to catch the eyes of potentially more people that could be the target of mismessaging, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it certainly raised the temperature in the room to the highest degree that it's been in decades, kind of thing. And, you know, I think there's a lot more at stake than
trans rights are near and dear to my heart, of course, and central to anyone listening to this. But I do think it's bigger than trans rights. And I think that was an easier wedge, if you will, for the parties that were behind these bills. The Alliance Defending Freedom, for example, that's constantly out there. You can trace almost every one of those bills back to that organization in one form or another. So it speaks to the very vocal and well-funded minority that is pushing this type of rhetoric. Lost the thread a little bit there, Sin, but in terms of, was it all about just bringing it into public eye? I actually don't believe so. I think that was one of the intended goals for certain, but I do believe that certain of the organizations thought that they would achieve everything that was on the table. They've done a lot of damage, despite the fact that so many bills have fallen by the wayside. We've seen it happen in states like Georgia, where they died Sindai, and there's some 20 bills that happened in Iowa where the legislature closed and none of the bills got through. But they've opened the door to keep bringing them back. And I think I do think the real goal that was there is, let's move the goalposts and keep hammering on it. So I don't think we've seen the end of it either. And the only way to see the end of it is vote. You know, get out there and make your vote count, and let's stop this. And we have seen some positive trends on the voting front in recent elections, whether it's school boards or the last congressional cycle. I know I'm speaking U.S. politics to a Canadian audience, but I think we're going to see it repeat itself here, and we already are, thing. So I think that blueprint has now been imported into Canada, and we're seeing organizations trying to use it. The reality is, we can also see the lived experience south of the border and make this a quicker circuit, if you will, to bring it to an end. If people are paying attention. So,
exactly. Thank you, Terry. Thank you so much.
Happy to join. So, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today, and we can't wait to hear about your travels and talk to you again. Hopefully we'll see you in Toronto when we're there later this year, and if you're out east here in Halifax or the Atlantic, you'll have to reach out to us.
I'd love that. Okay, Emma, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sam.
Thanks so much for coming in. It's been wonderful having you.
You're welcome.